and welcome to your weekly matinee. Have you ever been to the movies and thought, wow, that Transformers got a huge budget. What could possibly go wrong? Well, today we're going to talk about what could and has possibly gone wrong. I'm one of your hosts, Philip Ullman.
I'm Nate. I'm another one of your hosts.
I am Matt, and I can't believe the Meg made over $150 million while Scott Pilgrim only made like half its budget.
Did it? Yeah. I didn't know that.
The Meg was a good movie.
Oh, yeah. Who could forget?
Jason Statham fights a shark hand to hand.
Well, it was like mentioned like absentmindedly in the last episode, but Scott Pilgrim is one of my favorite movies of all time. So I actually, finding out that it made half its budget back? That's upsetting.
Around that.
That's actually upsetting.
Made with $60 million and made over like a little over $31 million domestically.
No.
That's
so sad.
Scott Pilgrim is such a underappreciated film.
I agree.
Very much so.
That's the case with today, though, is that there's a lot of like really good movies that go under the radar, don't make as much money as they should. Even Spider-Verse, like we talked about last week, did not make nearly enough money as it should have.
Yeah, like, I feel like risk isn't rewarded as it should be in the film industry. Like, Spider-Verse is, like, visual style, or, like, same thing with Scott Pilgrim. I'm trying to think of other risks that, like, aren't just visual style.
Because in terms of movies, there are a lot of great ideas artistically, like, for example, Spider-Verse, but they're not good ideas financially. Like, it's something that'll make a good movie, but not something that'll make you a lot of money.
Visual style, I feel like, is the only one that I can think of, though, because, like, obviously it's the most in-your-face. But, like, a movie can take risks without being in-your-face about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot of risk-taking today, visually or story-wise. Like, look at some of the movies that have broken a billion recently, such as Aquaman. Like, Aquaman is not a bad movie in any way. It's a very enjoyable movie, but it is not
It's very, like, milk toast.
Exactly.
I haven't seen it. I'm just assuming.
It's just not very new.
I would argue, like, people were praising Marvel for, spoiler, for Infinity War, killing half the cast, but, like, theoretically, putting actual danger in your action movie isn't something that should be praised, if you think about it. Like being like, oh, wow, the characters were actually in danger this whole movie. Like, cool. Like, yeah.
Yeah, but even with that risk, when it goes too over the top, you know it's going to be fixed in some way.
And I would like to point out, I'm not saying Infinity War is a bad movie. Like Infinity War, I enjoyed it a lot, at least.
Talking about formulaic movies, you know, like Marvel's extremely formulaic. They're not bad, but they're just the same way.
Phil, going back to what you were saying before about how, like, the idea of danger, I'd argue that it makes the movies a lot, like, having characters be in actual danger makes it a lot more intense and
you're
a lot more invested.
That's why a story like Game of Thrones is so compelling. Because, like, you've seen the stakes raised, and then they've been paid off, you know? Like, I don't watch it religiously, but there have been times where it's like, oh, like, this character might die, and then they do, you know? It's like, oh, okay, like, there's actual consequences to this world, making it a much more engaging world to follow.
The other side of...
I was just going to say, whereas, like, Marvel has made, like, the same movie 20 times, theoretically.
The other side of, like, that coin of setting up is, like, even the Meg, as we mentioned before, that is a very, very bad movie that did make its budget back and, like, did relatively well, but it did kill almost all of its cast pretty periodically. But, like, I don't feel like... When danger is done right, yes, it adds to a movie, but when specifically in, like, a movie that just doesn't take the time to set up its characters,
that's true.
The danger doesn't mean anything.
Game of Thrones is probably, like, a really bad example, because theoretically Game of Thrones has, like, a good like hour to set up its whole story and lead up to the next episode. So it sure, it's like an episodic format, but it's almost like it's releasing movies on a TV basis. It's a really interesting concept the way they're doing it, honestly.
That's sort of like what HBO.
Yeah, like it's what for. HBO is all about. It's just like, I think a show hasn't really utilized it as much as Game of Thrones. Or maybe, I don't know if you've watched Suits.
No, I haven't.
My parents were watching it and I caught some of it. It seems really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just... Another movie that like people often find bad, in my opinion, that people find bad but I enjoy, is The Expendables. Like, admittedly, The Expendables aren't really that amazing of films, but I still have fun with them. And in some cases, I feel like they establish and make me care about their characters more. Like, I'm more worried about them getting hurt in those movies than I am in other movies. And those are considered bad movies, you know?
Mm-hmm. I was leaving a pause for Matt to say something. I'm sorry.
I don't know. It's kind of difficult to explain what makes a movie like feel intense compared to forgettable fluff, like how I feel the Transformers movies are. Like, I feel like those movies are like forgettable fluff.
I would agree. Go ahead.
No, sorry. I grew up with the Transformers movies, which sounds so weird, but they'll always have a special place in my heart. You know what I mean?
I know what you mean, but I think for me, at least, I was old enough where Transformers was my first theatrical disappointment. Like, yeah, definitely.
Transformers to me is the kind of movie where I'll sit down and watch it and just be like, wow, giant robots fighting, you know?
Yeah, but they're even better, like, giant robot movies. Like, I really liked Pacific Rim.
Oh, Pacific Rim is such a good movie.
Yeah.
I haven't seen Pacific Rim since theaters. Yeah, I'm sure it's still fine.
It's good. The second one is not very good.
There was a second one?
There is a second one.
Yeah.
It's not very good.
I don't know. It's difficult to figure out why the Transformers movies are so bland and repetitive, and also why people keep flocking to them.
Because I feel like they're mindless. I feel like that's why a lot of bad movies are popular, because to some extent, they're just dumb entertainment.
Well, also they're marketed to kids, and
that is true.
Where the kids go, the money follows, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, a kid goes, they can't go see Transformers on their own, so that's three tickets right there.
And even with those movies, as Matt said, it's hard to define what is bad about them, but it just doesn't take the necessary character developmental risk. It doesn't make the best stylistic choices. Like, whereas Bumblebee, which came out recently, personally I haven't seen it, but a couple friends of mine have seen it, and they've told me that it's a very stylistic, it's good movie. Well, relatively good movie, because it's just like classic, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard that one barely made anything.
That's the thing. Like, I feel like reviewers, they'll point out when a movie is like stylistic or like has a strong visual impact, and for a lot of people who might read reviews before seeing a movie, that might turn them away. Maybe even, yeah. It's very possible that they're just like, well, this movie is very obviously not the simple watching experience I'm looking for. I just want to sit down and look at a movie.
That is true. Like, the Transformers movies are a lot more safe.
But,
for people,
but
they're,
you could
very
argue a movie with a much more like strong visual style is a lot more interesting to just sit down and look at.
True. It's more interesting, but the Transformers a lot more simple, and like people are drawn to things that are familiar.
Safe. Yes,
I guess, and safe, familiar and safe.
Well, you flock to what you know.
Exactly. And I'm not saying that's a good thing. I think
it's also not theoretically a bad thing.
I'm not saying that either. I just think people should really
take risks,
branch out in terms of the movies they watch as well as the movies they make.
Yeah, but often with stylistic movies, often they have a good script, and a good script sometimes is not necessarily complicated, but sometimes makes you think. And honestly, a lot of the movie-going people don't watch movies to rewind. You know, they watch them to rewind. They don't unwind. My bad. They don't watch them to think. It's just a fun little activity.
You know, like your little Freudian slip right there, though. I think it actually works. Like, nobody watches a movie to think, cool, now I want to watch it again and see the beginning in the context of the end. People mm-hmm. who go to see, like, a Transformers movie is like, cool, big robots fighting. But, like, Spider-Verse, again, for example, is like, cool, now that I know how the plot resolves and like all the conflicts, resolutions, and, like, the post-credit scenes, I want to see everything in context now, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. I think it's just a matter of... There's also the matter of taste difference, because if you're not super involved in film or you just have a different taste than others, what's bad to someone is good to you.
Yeah, that's verging on the idea that, like, oh, everything's subjective, which is, like, yeah.
Another thing that just reminded me of that I want to bring up is also nostalgia, which is why probably the Marvel movies and Transformers movies are so huge.
I don't know about those two specifically. I would say something like, maybe, like the Ghostbusters thing, like why people thought that would do well. Like the reason mm-hmm. that got approved was nostalgia.
Because it got brand recognition.
But like I would argue Marvel movies have transcended nostalgia, and maybe even Transformers have as well. But because...
Can you repeat that?
I would say that they've transcended nostalgia at this point because they've gone past their original generations, and now like there are 5-year-olds who love Tony Stark.
They're just cultural phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They've become so...
Yeah.
Well, at least Marvel stable. Movies. Yeah. Marvel movies are so much bigger than themselves, like in their own like timeline and universe, as well as in our world. Like Captain Marvel had so much controversy around it because people thought like it was like, oh, all SJW and all that mm-hmm. garbage, because people think these movies are important.
Mm-hmm. I know. We live in a day and age where superhero movies are like the big talking point in political controversy.
Yeah, Phil, you brought up a great point with that, because like I think I've mentioned this to you guys before, but with Wonder Woman, I did not see any really big controversy. I just saw, okay, DC's trying to make another movie, and Wonder Woman was an amazing film.
I loved it.
There was no like super big controversy. I thought it was
great up until the last like 15-20 minutes.
I still liked
it. I still liked it too. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what? I always bring this up whenever I talk about it because it's so just incredible to me, is that I didn't realize Gal Gadot was pregnant during that the filming.
Oh, that's right.
They wrapped green screen around her stomach, I think.
Yeah.
For parts of the Themyscira, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting. It's impressive. That movie is really good. Like, although
I know, like, even something like Black Panther had a lot of, like, political...
Yeah, and I don't get it, because, like...
controversy around it.
Like, I get it, like, theoretically.
I never saw any of that when I was watching the movie.
That was a good movie.
The thing with Black Panther that really interested me is, and I think Matt and I, we definitely got a really interesting perspective because of where we were physically when that movie came out in our high school. Our high school was very, very, very borderline white supremacy. Like, we had a lot of people who were like, you might not make it out in the real world. So, like... do you remember, I'm not going to say his name, but we had a kid who would sit at our lunch table in the morning who was literally like, yeah, I'm not going to see Black Panther. There are too many black people in it. And it's like, whoa, what?
That's just an unwillingness to broaden.
Meanwhile, I'd argue Black Panther is actually probably one of the MCU's strongest films.
Oh, it's one of the best. It's recently ranked all of the movies on Letterboxd, and Black Panther is pretty high up there.
My personal favorite, if you care, is probably Ant-Man, the first one.
Mm-hmm. Guardians 2.
Oh, you know what? You know what? Yeah, maybe. That movie's so good. That's... Next episode, Guardians.
All right. So another thing I want to bring up is, I can't remember if it was Phil or either one of you mentioned that the reason Transformers was so huge is because they market to kids.
Yeah, that was me.
And that's why they're able to make, and because they can't go out and see the movies on their own, they make a lot more money from more ticket sales that way. What about a movie that is obviously that kids cannot see yet has still made millions of dollars,
like Deadpool,
domestically at least, like Deadpool's 50 Shades of Grey?
Well, I'm not saying bad movie. I thought you were saying like that kids still saw.
Des?
Like 50 Shades? You hear me? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that made, domestically, it made over $166 million.
So you see, that turned every AMC into a porno house for like a good couple months.
50 Shades was just like, that was just another brief period. You know, like that was just an exciting time to people, like for people, I guess.
I would argue that those movies are big for the same reasons that like the Mission Impossible movies are big. It's just like people are excited to see something like that for some reason, you know?
What does that do with Mission Impossible?
I don't know. I was just trying to think of a big budget film that like people love that like isn't Marvel.
The difference between that though is that Mission Impossible, some people can view it as bad, but I still view them as relatively good.
I view them
good.
As pretty great.
I've never seen a single one of them.
Oh, really?
Really.
I suggest watching them. They're really good.
I'll keep that in mind.
Maybe you should do that as your topic.
I know.
Yeah, you're choosing. We'll do that in the third episode.
Yeah.
I will keep that in mind for upcoming categories.
Little sidebar. We're filming two episodes today. Because of
me. Yes, we are. Because Bill has to be somewhere next week.
We're not going to pick a new topic at the end of this episode, but we will discuss last week's topic, which was Matt.
We're doing it now?
No. I'm just asking you to remind people.
Okay, it's Paul Thomas Anderson movies.
Okay, so that's what we'll be talking about at the end. Real quick, I know I did one of these last week, but just a reminder. So this episode that you're currently listening to was supposed to originally be episode 2, and last week's episode was originally episode 3. Now, there's nothing wrong with them out of order other than the continuity, which I guess is pretty important. So at the end of this episode, we're discussing Matt's topic, and I think at the beginning of the next episode we will discuss Nate's topic. So yeah, again, sorry for the confusion, and thank you for bearing with us. But back onto our original topic, you kept bringing up Aquaman. Is there something like inherently like bad about a superhero movie though? Because like I'd argue like theoretically, some people could have argued the same thing about, like, the original Spider-Man or the original Hulk, even.
Aquaman.
Well, the original Spider-Man at the time was, I think, the highest grossing movie worldwide.
Was it? Didn't it come out after Titanic, which is
still
currently? Isn't Avatar's on top now, isn't it?
I don't think Titanic's still on top. It's close, but James
Cameron. I think it was the highest grossing summer movie?
Yeah, the difference between that, Spider-Man, I know we said last week we were talking about Spider-Man, but like the first Spider-Man is a good movie. It's quality. It's not like amazing, and there's a lot of weirder stuff, but like it's a good, solid movie.
It has my boy Bonesaw.
Exactly, my boy Bonesaw. James Wan is an amazing director, and I think he saw the movie for what it needed to be, which was just a fun little romp.
In an interview, he mentioned that he had a choice between Aquaman and The Flash, and he chose Aquaman because, as he puts it, he likes the underdogs.
I think he did an amazing
Aquaman
job with Aquaman. Yeah.
I would have so
and Aquaman is a character.
Flash movie. Flash is like one of my favorite DC heroes.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, Matt.
Yeah, it's all right. And so Aquaman is a character that's just so looked down upon by so many people.
As someone who like actually knows some of his backstory and like has read a few of the comics, like I've never looked down on Aquaman.
Yeah, no,
he's actually
Aquaman.
He's theoretically probably one of the coolest DC characters.
He is. He's a cool character. It's just that movie. You haven't seen Aquaman?
I have not.
Aquaman is just a fun like travel around the world, don't question how they got to these places kind of movie.
Oh, that's cool.
I will say
that's probably exactly what it needed to be though.
Exactly, but it wasn't amazing. There was no reason for everyone to get so like, oh, this movie's gonna blow the roof off the box office, which it did, but I don't know, it just wasn't amazing. It was okay.
While we're on the topic of DC, a trailer just came out. the Joker trailer or something.
Oh, yeah. That trailer looks so
It looks good. really cool.
I haven't seen it yet. It's
the director of the Hangover movies, Todd Phillips.
Is it really?
Is that his name, Todd
Phillips? But starring Joaquin Phoenix, one of the greatest actors.
Amazing. Of...
That actually, I might go watch the trailer after this.
You should watch Joaquin Phoenix movies.
We can pause the podcast real quick and I can watch it.
Go for it.
So I just saw the Joker trailer. It looks really cool.
Mm-hmm.
No Batman. I hope there's no Batman in this movie.
Well, Bruce Wayne was in it.
I hope there's no Batman.
That was the kid that he put the smile on.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be a good movie. DC, I honestly think DC's going to pick up as time goes on. Because, well, let's look at, like, Man of Steel... Unpopular, this is an unpopular opinion, but Man of Steel is one of my favorite superhero movies of all time. I'll be completely honest. I just, for some reason, everything just hits right with me in that movie.
Really?
And I don't know why, but it really just does.
I think Batman v Superman got a really bad rap.
I'm in an odd experience with Batman v Superman because I have watched the 3-hour edition like 10 times. And it really grows on you after a while.
I only saw it once, and I enjoyed it.
Not that it's a good movie, but it's just enjoyably convoluted, you know?
You know, the only thing that bothers me is the thing that bothers everybody, and it's the whole, like, thing with their moms.
Yeah.
But, like... Little
Martha.
Yeah. But, like...
Martha!
I liked it, you know?
I understood what he was trying to do by saying Martha, because, like, to help, like, Zack Snyder, he was trying to make it like, oh, Superman is an actual human being, too.
He has a mom. He loves
his mother, yeah.
Mommy!
But it just wasn't executed as well as it could have been.
No, there's much better and probably even easier ways to make somebody seem human.
Zack Snyder is honestly a perfect example of what we're talking about with bad movies, because he has made... so many movies that are divided right down the middle to if they're bad or not.
That is true. I mean? Watchmen is extremely divisive. Like, people either love it or hate it.
Exactly. It's very interesting as to why, you know?
I'm like, drawing a blank on, like, what other movies are like that, though, you know? Like, I feel like so many movies, even, like, big-budget ones, especially big-budget ones, mm-hmm. are, like, a lot more quality than they used to be.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like... a lot more money is being put in the right places nowadays, in Hollywood at the very least.
Yeah, but then we get a lot of bad.
For the most
movies.
Part,
yeah, no, we there get a lot. Of bad
there's
movies.
Still a lot of garbage in Hollywood.
Like, let's look at some of the bad movies that haven't really been done well, like The Grinch.
Like Suicide Squad.
The Emoji Movie, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah, that's true. I didn't even think of the Emoji Movie.
There's just a lot of like.
Yeah.
You know, on the idea of, like, CG animation, I feel like the Minions get a bad rap, too.
The solo Minion movie was not very good.
I enjoyed it for what it was.
That's true. I did enjoy it for what it was.
Of all of Illumination's movies, I've only seen the first two Despicable Me movies and the Lorax movie.
Despicable Me is a good movie.
I actually like the first two. I haven't seen the second one since theaters.
I really liked the first one.
Yeah, the first one was good.
I enjoyed it.
The second one was not bad. The third one was a little...
I heard that they really dipped in quality after a while.
The second one was pretty good. It was okay. It was fun. It's a child's movie.
But, like, Illumination animation in general, like, really dipped in quality after a while.
Did anyone here see The Grinch?
I did.
I know Nate saw it.
How was it?
It was a money grab. It was unnecessary, and it took no significant or necessary risks. It just changed a few story points to make it fresh without adding anything to the story.
Mm-hmm.
My biggest, like, the thing I was most skeptical about was how Benedict Cumberbatch would do in that role.
He was fine.
Yeah, I mean, he's a great actor. It's just, like, you can only do so much, and I'd argue he's more suited for a little bit more of a serious role than the Grinch. I'm sure he did fine.
Yeah, no, he did. He wasn't the issue. The whole
it probably doesn't help that, like, I, like, when I think of Cumberbatch, I think of like Sherlock and Doctor Strange,
mm-hmm.
which are arguably the same character. Yeah, I'm obviously joking. Yeah, I'm obviously joking.
Yeah, no, The Grinch is a great example. It was just that was a more of a money, but that's how you describe a lot of Illumination's movies. You know, there are a lot of money grabs.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
they're cashing in on older ideas. Like The Grinch, so Jim Carrey's The Grinch, obviously, that's a bit divided. A lot of people say it's bad, a lot of people say it's good.
I liked it as a kid, I don't like it anymore.
But you have to give it is that it took risks and there was passion behind it. But
debatably.
That, The Grinch today, the animated one, just didn't have any of that. It just felt very formulaic.
I feel like...
It didn't have a vision.
It didn't have any style. Yeah.
And, like, I don't mean this to, like, gatekeep art or anything. I feel like animation's too easy to do now. You know what I mean? Like it's so easy to just throw a couple million at a project and be like, make a good movie when it's animated, you know? Mm-hmm. Or make an okay movie that'll at least break even.
Well, animation nowadays is so cheap, and that's not to discount the hard work of the animators.
No, I'm sure a lot of the people who worked on the Grinch movie, like, that's one of the greatest things they'll ever do.
The Grinch looked fine, you know, like they're amazing animators, but they're cheap movies that bring in a lot of cash. You know, it's like horror movies nowadays, you know?
It's just like when you're writing a script for an animated movie, there's so many things that you don't have to consider that you would have to consider if you were doing a live action movie. Like, you don't have to consider, like, can this actor physically pull this face? Or does the camera, like, is there a way we could get this camera into a position that makes this scene make sense? Because in the animation, the answer is always yes.
It's a lot more freeform.
Animation is limitless.
Exactly.
When animation is given to people, not just as an assignment, but as like a passion project, that's when it shines the most. You know what I mean? Like, look at Disney. Like, that's the one thing about Disney that, like, I absolutely love. Like, Frozen. I love Frozen.
I adore Tangled. Frozen.
Mm-hmm.
They're just great movies. You know, I'm not sure if Disney, like, there's just people that cared about the projects. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. On the topic of Frozen real quick, I want to put this out in the world. So I recently rewatched Frozen with my sisters and my mom, because my mom had never seen it, and my sister was like, you have to watch it. And I realized my favorite song in that movie is Love is an Open Door, because it's the best.
That movie is so good.
So I really hope the second one has, like, a reprise of Love is an Open Door, but it's Anna and Kristoff. I really want that.
I'm really excited for that movie, actually. But that's, like, another example of, like, bad animation versus good animation, you know? There was passion
behind that.
Like,
Frozen versus the Emoji Movie.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's much of a comparison there. Yeah.
Well, the thing is, Frozen is super impressive from an animation standpoint, too. Like it takes visual risks. Like, the whole thing with Elsa's hair. Like, each, like, strand is, like, generated, like, with algorithms upon algorithms. Like, there's a lot of shit that goes into that one scene of her pulling her hair out.
Look at Thanos, even, you know?
Yeah. I'd say that his CG was okay enough to the point where it was, like, not jarring.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's like, you look at him and it's like, okay, well, duh. Like, but, like, it's
who
not
is
like,
this?
Thanos.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Josh Brolin.
Like, his CG was very well done.
Yes.
On the topic of, like, bad movies, like, Trolls, you know? Like, that's another bad animated movie that's getting a sequel, I think. And it has a
yes.
TV show.
And if you didn't know, the McElroy brothers from the podcast My Brother and Me will be in it, apparently.
Because going back to what Phil said before, how it's marketed to kids.
That's true. Maybe I just have a, like, a older, kind of bitter look at it. But mm-hmm. when I was in the theaters watching it, I just did not enjoy it. I did not have fun with it.
A movie like Trolls isn't made for people like us.
Exactly, yeah.
It's not.
Although, but I feel like every movie should be made for everyone. You know what I mean? Frozen, let's look at that. That's made for a chill child, but it is honestly one of my favorite movies.
I'm sorry, chill child?
Shut up. Made for a chill child.
Chill child.
A chill child. I see what you did there.
Yeah, Ma. Maybe I'll see Frozen. Maybe I won't. It's maybe, you don't know me.
It's made for children, but I still absolutely adore it, you know?
And then, maybe I'll have a chicken nugget. Maybe I won't.
When we also need to look at phenomena, bad movies like The Room and Sharknado. What makes them desirable?
So bad it's okay. So bad it's good is an entirely different story.
Yeah, but because how do we divide bad from so bad it's good?
What differentiates a movie like The Room?
Is it so like bad that you enjoy it?
The like what trolls. Point does it hit that? Because what The Room does is it makes the choices it makes are so baffling. Mm-hmm. Like at least with a movie like Transformers, like you understand what they're going for. They're trying to make a fun, crowd-pleasing action movie. And it just doesn't work out. With The Room, you have no idea what it's trying to do.
You know what I think is another thing? And I'd argue games, video games, hit a very similar thing. Where, like, I don't know if you remember a couple years back on YouTube, a game got really, really popular. It was called Goat Simulator. Mm-hmm. And that got really popular because people were like, haha, look, funny glitch. But that game never did it for me because it's a game that never took itself seriously, not being serious. But again, it's super funny when a game like GTA 4 glitches out because that game's like, yeah, we're a real game. And then a car flies across the map. Mm-hmm.
Okay, The Room is a movie that Tommy Wiseau tried to make a really serious, compelling drama and failed miserably at it.
What I feel like a lot of bad movies come down to, in my opinion, is that a good movie versus a bad movie, I'll see the passion. I think I enjoy The Room because he put in so much of himself, you know what I mean? He put in so much passion that how can you not enjoy it? And I feel like that's the difference, in my opinion, of bad versus good movies or so bad it's good movies, is that I see passion. Whereas like with movies that lack that, with like that lack someone of like a significant view, you know what I mean? I feel like that's the difference. When somebody cares about it, I feel like I'm always going to enjoy it.
So you'd argue So Bad It's Good is a movie that has passion behind it but still misses its mark.
Exactly. Whereas I feel like a movie that
So then why isn't The Grinch So Bad It's Good? Because I'm sure some of the people who are in
it's not so much passion.
No passion in that movie, The Grinch.
It's like, it looked like it's a uniqueness. Like you can think of a ton of different movies that are feel like The Grinch. The Grinch is completely indistinguishable.
Exactly.
A ton of other animated. It's bland. It's generic.
You see, I think
it's boring.
I think you asked the perfect question. What is the threshold of so bad it's good? And I'd argue
I'd argue passion.
I'd argue that misses something.
What passion?
No, like just saying like if there's passion behind it, because, like I'm sure somebody's passionate about filming porno, but is porno so bad it's good? Some of it is. Not all of it.
Don't really think that's a great example.
I think it's compassion combined with incompetence.
Yeah. I don't know. I feel like a good movie to me is when I see somebody put effort into it. You know what I mean? It's like The Room. I see that Tommy put effort into it, so it's enjoyable to me. It's still like a bad movie.
Here's how I see it. Like, you know when someone's trying to tell a joke and they fail horribly at it? They fail at being funny. Huh?
I don't. I've never experienced that.
Or like, say someone's like doing a stand-up routine.
It's funny. It's a good joke!
Stop it!
The mark on that one.
That was
the
joke.
I'm trying to make a point. And so when someone's like doing a stand-up routine, they're failing horribly at it, it's really awkward and cringy. Whereas, say someone is trying to do like a Shakespearean monologue and they want you to take them seriously and they fail horribly at it. Like, it's funny. They're trying to be serious but failing at it.
That's what I was going to say. I was going to counteract your passion with tone. Because the Room is very obviously trying to take itself seriously. But you, as a viewer, can't because of its content.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I see. I see a mix of the two. You know what I mean?
Kind of. Like, I get what you're going for.
Mm-hmm.
So, Nate, do you want to say your final thoughts on, like, bad movies? Like definitive what's so bad it's good, and, like, why movies like Transformers do so well?
As I said, I feel like the difference is the effort that I see put into it, you know? If it looks formulaic, if it feels like no one really cared about its final thing, then I won't enjoy it. But if I see as someone actually tried and cared about the final product, then I'll at least enjoy it to some extent, or at least it'll be so bad it's good.
Okay. Yeah, I can see where you're coming from. Matt?
Basically, just all I have to say is a message to filmmakers that if we want to see more movies, like unique, stylish movies like Scott Pilgrim, Spider-Verse, and even the movies that we're about to talk about right now, like more artistic films, then filmmakers, take more risks in the movies that you make, and moviegoers, take more risks in the movies that you watch.
I actually, for my final points, I want to build on top of Matt's. I'd say take more notes from traditional literature. I'm not saying take a book and make that into a movie. What I'm saying is realize what books do, which is have subverted meanings, and do that more. Like, have a message to your film. I feel like yes, you can make a movie just to make a movie, but I feel like for every one of those you do, you should do two with a message.
That actually means something.
Yes.
Yeah.
And now we move on to categories.
All right.
Matt, do you want to introduce it?
Introduce it? All right.
Yeah, and even start off, why not?
So the category that I chose was movies directed by Paul Thomas Anderson, because I've been a fan of the couple of movies of his that I've seen, and I want to introduce to Nate and Phil. And so the movie that – I guess we'll just start with just the movies that we chose. And so I'll start off. The movie I chose was his most recent film, Phantom Thread, starring Daniel Day-Lewis. And do you guys go next, or should I continue on mine?
Do you just want to go down the line? We'll all say our movies?
Yeah.
Nate.
All right, I watched the movie Inherent Vice, starring Joaquin Phoenix.
Oh, who we were just talking about.
Yeah, exactly.
Punch Drunk Love? Did I say it in the right order?
Yep, you got it.
Hell yeah.
Punch Drunk Love, yeah.
With Adam Sandler.
Adam Sandler. Good job, Phil.
No. Right. I wasn't confused on his name. Uh-huh. I knew what his name was. I know who Adam Sandler is. I've seen Eight Crazy Nights.
I've seen Jack and Jill. I know this man.
You're gonna die, clown!
What is that Netflix movie, The Magnificent Eight?
The Ridiculous Six.
The Ridiculous Six, yes.
Magnificent Eight? That's like The Ridiculous Six plus Eight Crazy Nights.
The Ridiculous Six is so good.
Can I actually start talking about love?
Punch Drunk Love? Yes.
Punch Drunk Love.
I'm just really bad with the title. I sat down, so I had a really interesting perspective on this movie because I sat down to watch it. I got like halfway through it, and then my power went out for a second, and I had to like reconnect to the Wi-Fi and whatnot. And by the time it had reconnected, I had already said whatever and gone to bed. So I had to finish it the next day. So my first viewing was like, I really did not enjoy it. But then, like, I don't know what changed. I, like, sat down, and I really enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm. Did you rewatch the whole movie, or did you continue from where you left off?
I continued from where I had left off.
Okay.
It's just, like, now, we're not gonna, like, write essays on, like, oh, what's the deeper meaning of this movie? But, like, it's just, like, a genuinely enjoyable film towards the end. And, like, you kind of get somewhat, you get the resolution of, what's his name again?
The main character, yeah. Barry.
Barry, thank you. You kind of get a good resolution for him, you know? Like I don't know about you, Matt, because I know you've seen this movie.
Mm-hmm. Would you mind saying, like, just giving a brief plot synopsis?
So he's lonely. He calls a sex line and it starts getting screwed by them. But while that's happening, he meets a girl, falls in love, buys a bunch of pudding, and goes to Hawaii.
Man, that sounds like quite the movie.
It's actually, like, have you seen it?
No, I haven't.
You should watch it.
I want to.
It's really good.
That was another one that I was thinking
of. It's in, the plot's insane.
He gets kicked out of a restaurant on his first date with that girl because she mentioned, like, something traumatic from his past, so he just, like, goes to the bathroom to calm down, and he literally tears the bathroom apart.
And Adam Sandler did good?
Yeah.
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 I feel like comedy actors usually play good dramatic roles.
I always forget that he isn't funny, haha, man. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
That he's actually a good actor.
Yeah, like yeah.
Like, he's genuinely great in that movie.
Yeah.
Like, I felt for him. I really felt for him.
Mm-hmm. I feel like Paul Thomas Anderson, based on what you're saying, is really good at making you feel something for your characters. Like, even with me and Joaquin Phoenix in that movie, I really felt for him, you know?
Matt, do you know if he directed or wrote?
Both.
He... Oh, wow, okay.
I think that for all of the movies that we watched, he wrote and directed them.
Yeah, for all the movies we watched, he wrote and directed also.
Like, specifically with, like, his, like, the directions he took, like, I'd say a lot of, like, the shots that were set up were really, like, just... I don't want to say convincing, compelling. That's what I'm looking for.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's a great shot of Barry in his office, and you have a perfect, like, view of his office entirely, and he's standing square in the door, perfectly out, like, boxed in by the door. And it's such a, like, it's a really pretty shot, even though it's nothing spectacular.
I feel like even based off that, like, does he film Barry like he's very isolated?
Yeah, very.
That's exactly how it felt like in... Inherent Vice, because I always felt like I was with Joaquin Phoenix. I'm sorry, I can't forget his name, Doc, in the movie. I always felt like I was with him. I'm sorry, I'm gonna let you finish yours. I was just saying,
no, that's fine.
Very similar to, like, the feeling that he's filming people as if they're lonely in the world. And even after reading a quick plot synopsis of Phantom Thread, I feel like that's a lot of what that movie is too.
Yeah. So, Phil, I was gonna ask you, because a similarity that I noticed between Phantom Thread and Punch Drunk Love. Did you notice while watching a movie a sort of color motif with, like, the colors blue and red?
I thought it was blue and pink.
Blue and pink. Because the girl starts out wearing red.
Oh, you see, what I'm thinking of is there's literally parts in the movie where it's, like, just bars of color are on the screen.
Like, can you say that again?
There's just, like, bars of color on the screen at certain points in Punch Drunk Love.
Yes, there are.
Yeah, that's what I thought you were talking about, and I thought those were blue and pink.
No, but, like, in terms of, like, the costuming.
Yeah, there was a lot of red, like, dresses, and he was always in the blue suit.
In the blue suit.
Yeah.
Because there's a similar motif with the two main characters in my movie. Their names are Reynolds and Alma. So, the basic... Do you want me to go into mine, or Nate, do you want to go into yours next? All right.
Go for it.
So, huh?
Go for it.
Okay, so Phantom Thread, it's takes place in the 1950s, and so a dressmaker named Reynolds falls in love with this younger waitress, and so she helps him by, like, trying on dresses, helping him make them and everything. And at a point around, like, halfway through, it's they're sort of at odds with each other because they're kind of, like, competing for dominance in the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of great symbolism with the colors out there, because, like, Reynolds' color motif is blue. Like, he usually wears, like, blue clothing. His house has, like, blue walls and everything. And Alma is usually wearing red clothing. And they do a lot of interesting symbolism with that. Like, there'd be a scene where she'd have a red lipstick on, and he said, like, no, I want to see you for who you are. Like, get... where he tries to, like, wipe it off, showing, like, he's trying to, like, get rid of her color, basically, showing that he wants control over her.
Uh-huh. I didn't notice, maybe I just wasn't paying attention. There was definitely strong use of color in Inherent Vice, but it's I didn't see like a lot of like consistent color use of like symbolism between your guys's movies. But there was definitely a strong visual and colorful aspect.
I would say in mine, I would say like use of shadows was super prominent. Like he would use shadows a lot to almost like divide an entire frame.
Like, oh yeah, another thing, Phil. Like, did you notice like a lot of shots were like? Did you notice like the lighting was like boosted? Like some shots were like extremely bright.
Super saturated. Some shots were I'd also say it's definitely not like a traditionally lit movie. It's like some of the movie is like dark when it shouldn't be, or theoretically shouldn't be, but I'm sure there's a reason. Because in film, nothing happens. Well, some things happen on accident, but most things don't.
Yeah. I feel like he captures a very unique... The way he tells a story and films his stories is very, very unique, you know? He definitely keeps... He keeps things fresh.
He's a great storyteller.
Yeah, he's amazing.
I'll give him that.
Inherent Vice was... I don't know how to say it. Like, it was very, extremely enjoyable movie that was, a little convoluted on purpose, I think. It was, it was just an excellent stylistic movie. Do you want me to talk about it? Do you want me to give the synopsis?
Yeah.
Pretty much Inherent Vice follows our main character, Doc, played by Joaquin Phoenix, as he searches for his, ex-girlfriend, when she disappears. And that, like, leads him to, like, conspiracies and drug cartels and, like, all that sort of thing. And he's a PI. He was, like, a hippie, sort of, in that time. So it was a very, like, drug-fueled PI sort of adventure. Which, as I said before, the whole movie made Joaquin Phoenix's character, Doc, feel isolated from the world around him. It definitely, the whole movie felt like one big hallucination. You know what I mean? Like, by the end of the movie, I was, like, thinking to myself, did any of that actually happen? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was just, it was a very cool, amazing, like, weird movie, you know?
I heard a lot of it felt like a drug trip.
Exactly. The whole movie felt like a drug trip. It felt like the whole thing could have been fake. Like, the main character, I forget her name. Let me just get it up. Shasta, that's the main character, his ex-girlfriend's name. Honestly, by the end of the movie, I was not sure if she was a real person, or even his friend. I don't know how to pronounce her name, but Sortilege, that's like her character, that's his friend's name in the movie. Even she feels more like a voice in his head rather than his actual friend. Like, you're questioning the entire movie whether anything that's happening is actually happening. There's, like, one part in the movie where he goes to this dentist center, which is a really, really weird part in the movie. But it feels so surreal and weird. It was just exciting, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It was cool. It was a cool movie.
I said everything I wanted to say.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What did you think of, Phil, what did you think of the music in that movie?
Probably didn't pay as much of attention to it as I should have.
That the music in Punch Drunk Love is also really bizarre, and
the whole movie's bizarre.
I feel like that's sort of like what all of his movies are, is a bit bizarre, but in a really good way.
Yeah, you know? I think that's actually a really good point to just tie it all together.
He tells.
He tells a fresh
story.
Remember, like, the first half of my movie, A Phantom Thread, is sort of like those two getting together and see their relationship growing. There's some, like, generic romance dialogue. Like, I can't remember the exact line. It's just like, you're the person I was, like, looking for my whole life. Like, a couple lines like that are, like, really cheesy and generic. But, like, after, like, about halfway through, when she puts something in Alma, she puts something in Reynolds' tea. And from there, I was on edge. It gets really intense.
Oh wow.
Yeah, that sort of reaches a point like that in Inherent Vice, where you're at that point, like three quarters through the movie, and you're like, okay, what is happening? Who is that? Is any of this actually happening? But I feel like that's all like it was amazingly on purpose, I feel, and it's extremely just very well-made movie, you know, and I feel like that's what it is for all the movies that we watched, you know. They're weird, confusing, not really necessarily confusing, but they're fresh, you know. They
But it all
feel.
serves to tell a story in a unique way. Like, it's not just weird for being weird.
Exactly, yeah.
Alrighty then.
And so, Phil, I have one last Punch Drunk Love question.
All right.
Did you notice? I don't know if you noticed this, but in the scene where Barry's talking, is on the phone with the sex line, did you notice that that scene is all one take?
Yes, I did.
At what point did you notice it?
You know what? It probably made me notice it, actually. It wasn't a point, it was just how uncomfortable it made me feel.
It was just what?
How uncomfortable it made me feel.
Oh.
You know what I mean?
He does a few of
Yeah.
those. There's one long take in Inherent Vice that was just very strange, you know? Like it's the camera's held in one angle for like 6 minutes or like
It's the kind
more.
of long, like the way he does long takes is like it makes you feel like you shouldn't be there. Like you're seeing something you
It's
shouldn't.
just it, yeah, it's
Yeah.
it's cool.
Like
He
there's
has
a
a
point.
cool
And
way
that's
of.
exactly how like Barry felt in that scene. Like he didn't want anyone.
Yeah. Anyway.
Okay.
So we're not selecting a category this week. It will be a weekly thing, but we're not doing it this week because we're recording two episodes back to back. So Nate will be choosing the category next episode. But until then, thank you very much for watching or listening. Whether that be on Anchor, YouTube, hopefully by now Spotify. If you enjoyed, subscribe or get notifications on your favorite podcast app. Share with your friends, and we'll see you guys next time.
Thank you for watching.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Listening.
Fare thee well.